paper topic is basically has a framework of a historical dialectic, so we're going to get directly into that now. So, remember, dialectic means thesis. Things are just puttering along in a certain way. Everybody's happy or thinks they're happy. And then something happens. There's a change. There's a problem or something new arises to address problems. There's conflict. And that's the antithesis. And then from the combination of thesis and antithesis, something new emerges out of it, which is a synthesis. So, last class, which seems like a long time ago, we talked about the Vedic religion, which had its ritual side, the karma kanda, what it's called in Sanskrit, karma kanda, the ritual division, the jnana kanda, the knowledge division. So, because of certain historical, well, what historians think were historical circumstances, about 2,500 years ago, there was a major cultural reaction against the status quo. And two of the results of that were Jainism and Buddhism. So, the problems. I mean, if everything's great and everybody's really happy, things don't tend to change. It's like you're in a relationship, and everybody's happy, then you just stay in the relationship. If one or both people have a problem, then, things start to change. And so, the problems were that the caste system, these varnas that we talked about, the brahmanas or the priests and teachers, the kshatriyas, warriors, basically the nobility, the vaishyas, the productive class, farmers and traders, and the shudras, the workers. If you look at the earliest literature, early Sanskrit literature, it's clear there was some degree of upward mobility and downward mobility, actually, for that matter. And so, at a certain point, the caste system became kind of very rigid. I mean, practically, we saw the same thing in America just now, to some extent, because studies show that in America, the gap between the rich and the poor has been increasing dramatically. In fact, it's the biggest gap now that's in the last 80 years, and so this creates social instability, and there was sort of a type of political revolt against this, and what the former president always wanted, regime change, took place in America. So you can see these factors that things are, when things become unstable, there's conflict, there's tension, people aren't satisfied. The people that have power become absorbed in maintaining and increasing their own power, their wealth, and then there's reaction against it. So this is basically what happened. About 2,500 years ago, the caste system became very rigid, and the people on top, especially the Brahmins, they controlled access to all kinds of desirable things. For example, the rituals. Everyone very much was into this religious system, and so the Brahmanas completely controlled the rituals. The rituals became more and more technical, and therefore you really couldn't do a ritual without a Brahman. It's just like now the legal system is very technical, so you really need lawyers, and the lawyers basically write the laws very technically, so you need lawyers. So, in the same way, the Brahmins, there was sort of a, you might say, that this priestly bureaucracy. And so you couldn't really be validated in life. I mean, basic things like getting married properly, or getting your children blessed, or making sure your parents went to heaven, or just making sure that you were respectable in society. All these rites of passage. This is not a secular society. This is a society in which religion is just completely woven into the fabric of society and is totally controlled at the top by these Brahmins. And this became a problem even for the kings, the second class, the rulers, because, and we'll see that actually this revolt to a great extent was patronized and led by people from the warrior class. Buddha was from the warrior class, and so was Mahavir, who started the Jain movement. They were actually both from the warrior class. So there was that conflict, class conflict. There was a moral issue also, because in the Vedic literature there are descriptions of animal sacrifice. And the understanding within the tradition, you could say from the more, virtuous element, was that this the animal sacrifices were a concession. It's just like in America, if you want to sell liquor, I don't know if any of you are really planning to sell liquor when you get out of college, but you have to get a liquor license, and the liquor license is very expensive, and presumably this is to sort of discourage the sale of liquor in a sense, so it doesn't proliferate too much. And so there are animal sacrifices, but they were never really performed that enthusiastically by, you could say, the saintly people in the spiritual traditions. But animal sacrifice kind of got out of control, and the tradition, within the tradition, you can trace this. You can trace this increase of violence in the sacrificial culture. So you get sacrificial literature being written, ancient sutra literature in Sanskrit, not only promoting animal sacrifice, but even getting to the point of saying that if there is a sacrifice and you don't kill an animal and you don't eat the flesh of the animal, then you'll go to hell or something, or something really bad will happen to you. It's kind of like, I mean, when people feel a little uneasy about what they're doing sometimes, like the best defense is a good offense. You can see this actually in the environmental movement. I mean, the United Nations has now declared that the cattle industry produces more greenhouse gases than all the motorized vehicles on Earth, and yet you won't hear Al Gore talking about this, and you won't hear the environmental movement talking about this, because, in fact, if you Google a very inconvenient truth, you'll find an article by one of the founders of Greenpeace and the head of the Sierra Club explaining how there's actually animosity in the environmental movement toward animal rights. So there was something like that. I mean, there are certain types of human emotions, there are certain types of psychological dynamics which just are eternal. And so you have literature being written saying that if you don't eat animals, sacrificial animals, you know, you'll go to hell. And so there was a reaction against this. There was a reaction against this increasing sacrificial violence. So that was the moral element. And it's not by accident that Buddhism and Jainism and other movements emphasize as the centerpiece of their teachings ahimsa, nonviolence, and a rejection of this violent sacrificial culture. So that was going on. So there's a social, moral tension, social caste tension, political, like I said, between the Brahmins and the kings. There's a geographical issue also, which led to the rise of these new movements. And that is here, this extraordinarily, extraordinarily accurate map of South Asia here. The earliest Vedic culture, say in the Rig Veda, the culture described in the Rig Veda, the people live on the Saraswati River. That's the main river. In later Hinduism, the Ganges, for example, is very important, the Jamuna. But in the earlier Rig Veda culture, the Saraswati is the river. And the Saraswati, according to satellite photography, actually flowed through what is now, I guess, near the border between Pakistan and India. This is sort of Pakistan here, and the Sindhu River coming down here. The Saraswati River. So basically, that earliest Vedic culture apparently was toward the west, toward the northwest of South Asia. And then it gradually moved toward the east, because by the time you get into, so to speak, classical Hinduism, the Ganges is the river. And the Ganges actually comes down from the Himalayan mountains here. Sort of photographic realism there. The Ganges comes down and basically goes into the Bay of Bengal. So, meanwhile, so here you have farther to the east in what was called Magadha, and now it's called Bihar, basically, the Indian state of Bihar. Back in ancient times it was called Magadha, which is sort of the, well, the Wild East. You know, in America we have the Wild West, well, they have the Wild East. And that's exactly how they looked upon it. If you read early literature, it's, you know, the Wild East, right, the early Vedic cowboys. And so, out here in the Wild East, I'll stop all my jokes here about this. So, that's where these movements arose, both Buddhism and Jainism. Because there, you have kings who are becoming powerful. It's sort of a rough area, but they're starting to get power, they're starting to rise, and they are more recently Vedic. And so the Brahmins don't have as much power there, and there's more resentment toward this sort of chokehold that the Brahmins seem to have in other places. And so therefore, it's in the east that these sort of cultural revolt starts to take place. And Mahavir apparently was from the second Kshatriya, warrior, noble caste, as was Buddha. Buddha was a prince from just up here, the foothills of the Himalayan mountains, and sort of just by the border of what is now Nepal. So you have all these tensions, all these historical tensions, and then a reaction to it, a sort of antithesis. And of course, all the reactions are not against Vedic culture. Within the Vedic culture, some people are reacting too. And they're staying within Vedic culture, accepting the authority of the Vedas, not rejecting it, but choosing a different kind of lifestyle. They go out in sort of a back-to-nature movement, go out of the wilderness. The idea is that if you stay in the towns, if you stay in the main cultural centers, the Brahmins kind of control everything, so if you want to get away, if you want to get more intellectual or spiritual oxygen in your life, then you kind of go out to the country. And so that was all these movements, whether they stayed within the Vedic fold or went outside, they're called the Shramana movements. And the word Shramana, by the way, wrote this down somewhere. Anyway. Oh, here it is. Yes.
From what you're describing, it seems the Brahmins were corrupting or taking into extreme the teachings of Vedas. So was the revolt against the Vedas itself or the control of
Both. It was both. Well, I mean, within the Vedic fold, the people who revolted were also Brahmins. Because there are Brahmins and there are Brahmins. So even within the Vedic fold, some of the Brahmins, they were the ones that went out and, you know, and were writing and studying books like the Aranyakas, the Upanishads, and they were tended more to meditation, to yoga, self-realization. There was a revolt. There was a revolt against the violence of sacrifice within the Vedic system. For example, at a certain point, you start to find in the sacrificial literature that rather than kill an animal and offer it, they'll sort of make a little, well, I mean, be a little facetious, sort of a gingerbread animal. I mean, they'll kind of make out of grains, they'll cook a little animal, and that becomes a substitute. They start substituting vegetarian, you know, animals. Sort of original tofu sacrifices. So they start to do that. And so, the reaction against the status quo takes place within and outside. Some people just go outside the Vedic system altogether, some people stay within it. And the ones that stay within it are also, in a sense, Brahmins. So the word shram, the Sanskrit verb shram means to be or become weary, tired, or tired of something, to make effort, exert oneself. Shramana means making effort, exertion, toiling, or one who does acts of mortification, like austerity. But it said that Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, actually starved himself to death. Whether he actually did or not, I don't know, but some people say he did, so that's pretty radical. A monk, a devotee, a religious mendicant. So, now, another example of, I mean, there was always a tension in the Vedas against animals, between those who wanted, those who didn't want to sacrifice animals. So one point I want to make is the reason that the Vedic culture ultimately predominated. What happened is, just to, you know, tell you the end of the story, then we'll go back and fill in the details. What's going to happen through history here is that the Vedic culture, in response to these very powerful challenges, because Jainism, although now it's a very small minority religion in India, at one point was actually a serious contender. And Buddhism, of course, was very prominent. And so the Vedic culture, in a sense, reinvented itself. It became lean and mean, it retooled, it became extremely competitive and eventually won in the form of what became Hinduism. And so, in a sense, when I say reinvented itself, all the elements of later Hinduism were already there in the Vedic culture. They just weren't being used, they weren't being engaged. But when the Vedic culture suddenly had to compete, they found within their own resources, all the elements of to make themselves competitive. So to give an example, in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest, basically it's the oldest book in India, and one of the oldest, perhaps the oldest book in the world, You have a statement in the Rig Veda that says, Sanskrit is, this is sort of archaic ancient Sanskrit, na vāvetan riyase narishyasi devāni deshi patibhi sukhebhi. For those of you who don't know archaic ancient Sanskrit, it means it's an address to the animal. As one is about to sacrifice the animal, you have to address the animal, because after all, the animal is also a person, right? No, here thou diest not, thou art not injured, in other words, because you're really a soul. By easy paths unto the gods thou goest. In other words, the idea from the Rig Veda is that the sacrificial animal is being elevated. The soul of that animal will actually be elevated to a type of material heaven. But there's that moral consideration for the animal. Then you have a statement from the Shatapatha Brahmana, which was the second layer of ancient Sanskrit literature, which says, an injunction, let one not eat flesh. Let one not eat the flesh of either the cow or the ox, for the gods spake. We don't talk that way now. This is sort of it's an old translation. The gods said, verily the cow and the ox support everything here, because it's an agricultural society. And so the cows give sort of the essential food, the ox are plowing the earth, so the cow and the ox support everything here. Hence, were one to eat the flesh of an ox or a cow, there would be, as it were, an eating of everything, or a going to destruction. And such a person who eats this flesh would be born again as a strange being, one of whom there is evil report, such as, here's an example of an evil report, he has expelled an embryo from a woman, abortion, which was frowned upon back then. He has committed a sin, let him therefore not eat the flesh of the cow and the ox. Nevertheless, and this is from the same text, Yajnavalkya, one of the famous Vedic sages, said, I, for one, eat flesh provided it is tender. So, Yajnavalkya, like, get a life, Yajnavalkya. So, anyway, the idea here is that there was a real tension. There was a conflict. It's not just this very simple Vedic culture. There's real conflict within the culture, just like there is within our culture. There are animal rights movements, and there are people that think that, you know, whatever. So there was conflict and tension. And in response to this new moral challenge, Buddhism and Jainism, we'll talk more about Jainism in a second, the Vedic culture found within itself these resources for a higher ethic, and began deploying these resources, and vegetarianism basically became kind of... I think this is really remarkable, frankly, that thousands of years ago in South Asia, people cared so much about these things that you could actually have a widespread, powerful animal rights movement thousands of years ago in this country. I find it impressive, personally, that, you know, they would care about all creatures, which I think is more impressive than not caring about sentient creatures that actually have feelings and feel pleasure and pain. Anyway, so any questions on that so far? Yes?
Did they discriminate on the animals that they were sacrificed? Did they give like priority to own goats or instead of the cow, or they did?
There was a general concern for all animals, and the cow... Oh, the sacred cow, holy cow. I think Batman, or who is it, Batman or Robin, they say holy cow. Anyway, the cow is not considered to be like a sacred totem. The idea is that because normally a child, of course, an infant takes its mother's milk, and because a child grows up with the milk of the cow is considered to be a mother, Gomata, the cow mother. And so therefore the cow was sacred in the sense that a mother is sacred. So it wasn't like some kind of mysterious totem. It was just, your mother is sacred. And so the cow is a mother, and so the cow is sacred. Yes?
As far as like, the Rig Veda is concerned, I know it was like orally cut down for a long time. How do they like explain like its origins? Was it like divinely inspired? Or?
According to the tradition itself, yeah, it was revealed. The sages saw it. There's this very powerful image you find throughout the Bhagavad Gita and even earlier literature, that knowledge is seen. You actually see the truth. And so the idea is that this is an eternal knowledge, which from time to time is lost and from time to time revived, and then the wise see this truth. So, anyway, one last point, then we'll get into some of the details of Jainism. I mentioned the term, I think, earlier, of a religious economy, and the essence of economy is not just like, I don't know, you know, selling lingerie or sporting goods. I mean, the essence of economy is that people want something and someone else has got it. And so they're going to negotiate. And so you trade value for value. So people not only have needs for physical things, people have needs, most people historically, have felt a strong need for some type of religion or spirituality. That's just appears to be empirically a very strong human need. And so the extent to which a religious or spiritual tradition can bring to the open marketplace of ideas that which people really want and need, it flourishes. And the extent to which they don't, they just don't satisfy people's basic religious and spiritual needs, pardon this crass language, they lose market share. So, you can find examples of this. For example, one simple example, in the 60s, there was not only the British invasion of music, they called it the British invasion of music, there was the Indian invasion of yoga and spiritual traditions. And existing religions like the Roman Catholic Church, different Protestant churches, in the face of this challenge, had to really go back to their own spiritual resources. And really, they very much reinvented themselves in many ways. There were all kinds of new, quote-unquote, spiritual movements among mainstream churches and Jewish traditions also. I mean, you find this in the Protestant Reformation, the transformation of the Roman Catholic Church in response to the challenge of Protestantism. And so these things happen. So, the Jains. Well, did you all find that thing in the course reserves? It was there? Okay. Just want to make sure it really exists. One quote is, one thing about Jainism which I found interesting is that, and you'll find the same thing in Buddhism actually, at least the what we will come to call the Hinayana or the earlier forms of Buddhism, is that there's the truth as they see it is often articulated in negative terms. And by negative terms, I mean grammatically negative terms. Like, we'll get to that later, but nirvana, the word nirvana is grammatically a negative word. In the sense that nir is a Sanskrit prefix, which means without. So without vana, trying to get rid of vana, which is the current of material existence. So the same way, one thing about these shamana movements is that often they tend to express themselves in negative language, although they would believe that their ultimate goal is positive, but still, the language tends to be negative. For example, world renunciation, giving up something, not embracing something, getting rid of something. World renunciation is the dominant religious ideal in Jainism. Is the dominant ideal is to get rid of something. Though pursued by a tiny minority, it plays a central role in the social life, retains a powerful hold on the imagination. There's no God. There's no God in this system. They have jiva, which is a word from the Upanishads, common sense word jiva, which means life. I think it's probably cognate with the Latin viva. In fact, in ancient India, if you wanted to say viva, viva, you would say jiva, jiva. So, next time you go to a Vedic party. So again, continuing this theme of not saying that it's negative in the sense that it's bad, but just they seem to express themselves negatively. And these are quotes from the text that you all read. Without help from any human or divine being, Mahavir waged war on himself. In the sense, his conditioned nature, his passions, and his karma. So in Jainism, harm to others leads to bondage, but waging war on the self, is the only path to salvation. So the Jains believe that there are jinas. The Sanskrit root ji, not like the American ji, you know, ji. But this is a Sanskrit root which means to conquer. And there's a common word which they say all the time in India, jai. They write jai like... Anyway, so from that you have the word jina, which means a conqueror, someone who has conquered themselves. gain control of themselves, conquer their... It's like we talk about overcoming a disease. So if you understand that your material condition, your material passions, your attachments, your karma is a disease, then you have to overcome that disease. So the great figures in Jainism were called jinas, conquerors, and that's where you get the word jaina. It's just a derivative word from jina. And they're also called tirthankaras. Tirtha in Sanskrit means literally a crossing. And it also is a common word in India for a holy place, like a place of pilgrimage. The way you say in India to go on pilgrimage is Tirtha Yatra, which means, you know, going to Tirthas. Crossings. The idea is, I mean, we'll talk a lot about this later, but the word for incarnation, when God comes to the world, it's called an avatar. And so ava in Sanskrit means down, and tara means crossing. So this tara in avatar, you've heard this word avatar, haven't you? Sorry, anyone? So the idea is that the divine person crosses down into this world, and then you go to the tirtha, you go to the holy place, and you cross back up. So it's the crossing word. You get trapped coming down and going back up, crossing from the material world to the spiritual realm, or the realm of enlightenment, or heaven, or, you know, however people understand that. So, but that's the word. And kara just means making. It's the same root, making. So literally making the crossing. Those are the Tirthankaras. So these are the titles they give to their great leaders, the Tirthankaras, the sort of the fort makers. Not in the sense of Detroit. Ford, like where you cross the river. For example, there's a famous college where they used to have the oxen cross. It's called Oxford. Right? That's what it was. It was the crossing over the Ox River. So, anyway, or Gina, the conqueror. Now, there are apparently, well, they claim there were 24 of them, isn't it? Of whom one is sort of solidly or somewhat solidly historical, Mahavir, and then he apparently was a follower of Parshva several centuries before, who's liminally or marginally historical, and the other 22 are beyond the horizon of what we would call academic historiography. But that's how the Jains see it. So the idea is that the soul lures karmic matter. You draw karmic matter here. So, you know, that there's all kinds of theories, like if you're kind of in a bad state of mind, you'll kind of attract all kinds of bad things into your life. And if you're really positive, you'll attract good things. That sort of that theory of psychological magnetism. So the idea here is that we lure, that's the word used in the book, in the article, karma. And what is this? So karmic matter, it's almost like a physical thing, the karma which attaches itself to you. And the way everyone else understands karma in India is that there are laws in the universe such that when you act and you do something, there's a reaction. So if you do something good, you get a good reaction. It's like you're eating. I mean, here's a simple example. If you eat good food, your body's healthy. That's sort of a John Lennon instant karma type thing. If you eat good food, you got a healthy body. If you eat bad food, you trash your body. And so the idea is that everything we do, including intention, for example, if you do something, let's say you do something for the wrong reason, like you're being nice to someone, but you're really trying to exploit them in some way. You kind of feel it in your gut. You know what you're doing. And so the idea is that somehow the universe reads your intention. And we'll get into this. We talk about Buddhism and other theories of karma. That what does this mean about the ultimate nature of reality? If the universe exists in such a way that the universe can read the most subtle nuances of your intention, how could there not be some consciousness at a cosmic level? Like, who's reading it? Where are the sensors? Who figures it out? Or what figures it out? But anyway, that's the idea, karma. Whatever you do, whatever you think, whatever you say, it's being monitored by the universe, and there's a response to it, a reaction to it. And because we are imperfect beings and we're selfish, therefore we are basically burying ourselves alive in all kinds of gnarly karma. That's the idea. And so we have these bodies that are lusty and greedy and proud, and this covers our real consciousness. The Jains believe that we are all originally omniscient, which is an attractive offer there. So, all-knowing. And I mean, if you think about it, for example, if someone is accused of a crime, a serious crime, and so they're doing jury selection. Of course, in America, the reality is that defense lawyers try to eliminate anyone that can think. But anyway, I won't go into the whole dynamics of jury selection in this country. It's pretty wild. But let's say they're doing jury selection. Let's say they're doing jury selection, and the defendant's mother, somehow or other, is one of the candidates. I mean, she can't be in the jury. Why? Because it is assumed that if there's strong attachment, which one would presume exists in a mother, a normal mother, strong attachment means you will not be or you cannot be objective. Or imagine if you are like really angry, you're like just out of control, enraged. You're not going to be at your most lucid. People may say to you, calm down, you're not thinking straight. Or let's say, for example, someone is burning, to use like sort of old language, burning in the fire of lust. And so they're not going to be at their most... In other words, the more we have, the stronger our desires are, the less we have the luxury of just being objective about things. Like if you're starving, you're just starving, you're so hungry, all you can think about is food. Like, is that food? No. Then get it out of my way. Where's food? So the stronger our desires are, the more our consciousness just becomes totally controlled by that. So therefore, this is a dynamic which you'll basically find in all the religions of the world, and you certainly find it practically in every Indian religion. The notion is that if you want to be enlightened, if you want to see everything as it really is, if you want to experience your highest, clearest, largest, best consciousness, you need to control your material desires, kind of, you know, you need to sort of purify yourself of these things. Plato talks about this, you know, the Greek philosopher Plato. So that's the basic idea, that we're covered by this karma, and we need to get rid of it so that we can regain our original pure consciousness. Okay, so that's Jainism. Now, they divide it, as Buddhism divided very early on, very soon after the historical Buddha went, wherever he went. There were, very soon afterwards, 18 different Buddhist groups. We'll talk more about that. Jainism just divided in two, the Shvetambaras and the Digambaras, which are, well, the people that dressed in white and the people that dressed in the flesh. The Sanskrit word ambara means clothes, and deep means the direction. So this is sort of a nice way of saying naked. Digambara means dressed in the directions. You get the idea. So, Shweta in Sanskrit means white, color white, so Shvetambara. Apparently there was a famine, there must have been a drought in North India. People had to travel to save themselves, so a group of Jains went to South India. And Mahavir himself went naked because he didn't want any possessions, including clothes, didn't want a wardrobe. And so down in South India, now South India, one thing about South India is it's surrounded by water, sort of like peninsular South Asia. Where'd my great map go? Here it is. So North India actually borders other places. Like here you have the Persian Empire, you got Central Asia up there, and Tibet. You know, there's things going on up there. Whereas if you live in South India, you're surrounded by water. And, you know, the fish have very little cultural influence on the Vedic culture. So South India is like the deep south of India. Sort of like, you know, we have the Bible Belt in America. So that was the Veda Belt. And in general, because they're just surrounded by water, they're just down there, they tend to be more conservative. They have been historically. And so Mahavir didn't wear clothes. We don't wear clothes. So the Jains that went down to South India, they just kept doing their thing. And the women, It's very interesting. According to science, apparently men are more visually aroused sexually, and women are more aroused by touch. So that's why you don't have a lot of magazines of naked men. But the idea is that everyone agreed, right or wrong, and I'm not trying to be judgmental, but they all agreed among themselves that women were not going to go naked. So, but the men were, at least the mendicants. And again, one thing that came out in the article is that most jades didn't really do this whole program. They were married, they had families, they had to work for a living, but they had their leaders, their the people they really revered, who did actually go naked. And the women know. Therefore, in South India, the women couldn't be liberated in this life. They couldn't be enlightened in this life because modesty, the necessary modesty for the ladies, meant they had to have a wardrobe. They had to have clothes, and if you have to wear, you can't be enlightened unless you're naked. I personally don't find this overwhelmingly persuasive that only the naked people can be enlightened, but it made sense to some people. So, now in North India, again, in North India, they're in contact with all kinds of other cultures. It's much, and so, they started dressing. Even the mendicants started dressing, and so since the men and the women were dressed, women had more rights. And so in a sense, you could see a more of a cosmopolitan spirit in the North. And so people in the South felt, people in the North, you're ruining Jainism, you've changed what Mahavir did, he didn't wear clothes, what are you wearing clothes for? And so it split into these two groups. Yes?
Are there any Jains now who still believe in the nakedness policy?
Is anyone here from India? Have you,
I've seen plenty of naked mendicants walking around.
Yeah, they're all what they call the Naga Baba, but in Hinduism, I think in the modern world, there's a lot less streaking going on in the modern world.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering.
There are some people, there are some sages still do that, males. I mean, I've even seen women who, women sages that were sort of semi-dressed or like would just sort of take bath in public.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you look at South Asia, they have, historically, they were not squeamish about the human anatomy, generally. Yes?
Background is so-called schism, per se,
mm-hmm.
Where were the Digambaras and the Shvetambaras, where were they concentrated geographically in North and South India?
Well, the original homeland of the Jains was, of course, in Magadha. And so they originally were a North Indian movement. They went to South India because of that famine. I can't give you more details exactly where they were in South India. So... Yes.
The term is supposed to be such a rejection of material, worrying about the broken things. And why is there this emphasis on whether you're wearing clothes or not? Why even worry about it?
Right.
Or why even worry about modesty?
Right.
Is there a justification for that? It seems, a little counterintuitive that would even be a concern when they're should all
right.
Have connections to the world.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. There's no God in this system. I think that has something to do with it. So there's no way in which the world comes from a divine being. It's just sort of bad. But what you're saying, if you're really enlightened, I suppose they might say that because of our present condition, if women go naked, all hell's going to break loose. And so it'll just be too chaotic, so we can't deal with it. They might say, I think at the bottom that's what it is. They couldn't deal with it. A lot of attractive women walking around naked. I think it was too much for them. But yeah, I agree with you. Yes?
Did they have any sort of, was it noticeably different that there were more men than women in Jainism, or it was equally?
There were a lot of women, too.
It was equal?
Yeah, I think there was In fact, in North India, I think there were even more women at some times.
It's just like weird because women can't be liberated, I guess. But I guess a lot of people in that area believed in the soul, so they just. I guess they were okay with having to wait for the next
year
to be liberated.
And I think, in North India, the women could be liberated.
Oh.
And so few of the people actually did the full-on program anyway. I mean, look, there's, like in the Catholic Church, for example, if you look historically, where only men could be priests, and yet there were so many pious women that were, really dedicated to the church. There's a long history of very dedicated women in Roman Catholicism. So a few more facts about the, talk about counterintuitive. There's something I always thought was kind of like, hey, and that is that they carried this ahimsa, nonviolence sort of to, all the way. I mean, even at a certain point in the 15th century, wearing face masks and everything. And so a mendicant, someone who's really on the fast track to omniscience, a mendicant can't, cook food, because when you cook food, all kinds of microorganisms and this and that, especially in India. I mean, it's a tropical climate. There's a lot of bugs and things and all kinds of creatures. That's just the nature of tropical places. And so what they do is the householders kind of they take the hit. They, the householders do the cooking. They get all the bad karma. And then they offer it. They got sort of like this. Think, okay, they just offer it to the mendicant. Well, if you're offering it to me, I'll eat it. And so the mendicant consciously, he won't cook because he wants the householder to get the bad karma. And I just thought that if you're a saint and your whole thing is compassion and everything and nonviolence and not harming anyone, why would you... And everyone knows what's going on. I mean, the mendicants know these people are cooking. This is they really cook great in this house. So I'm sure there was the shop talk among mendicants. Yeah, go three blocks down and turn left on Elm Street, and they got it. They really cook down there. So it's kind of let the householders take the hit, let them take the bad karma, and we're free. And so, I mean. It's almost like saying, I'll rob the bank, I'll kill the bank guard, I'll just give you the money, and then, you're innocent. I mean, that I killed the bank guard and robbed the bank, and you take the money, but you're innocent. Well, not exactly. Yes?
Is there any system of merit in Jainism?
Oh, yeah, most of them merit.
No, merit.
Oh, merit. I'm sorry, merit. Yeah, merit, the more ethical you are, the more you renounce the world, the more you are ethical. I mean, there's something very nice about it, this concern for all creatures. This is not humanism. It's not just human beings, because all creatures are concerned. So I think that's very positive. And so the more you are advanced according to their values, the more... In fact, although they rejected the caste system, they eventually took it back, but they said it wasn't hereditary, that a Brahmin means the most ethical person, the best Jain is the Brahmin. But when you have royal patrons, they must have merit because they're paying the bills. And in fact, in every religion, it's hard. You've got a religious institution, and if you don't get a certain amount of money, the thing's going to go crashing down. You can't maintain your institution, and someone's actually paying the bills. And so, so the king's they must be meritorious because they're paying the bills. So the caste system kind of came back. This is something you'll find again and again in Jainism and Buddhism. They're against the caste system, but it seeps back in. Sometimes it rushes back in.
I was going to say, wouldn't that apply to the householders as well? If they're giving food to the mendicants, isn't that a meritorious act?
It is, yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the most meritorious thing, to give to the mendicants. Even though they have to eat the bad karma, because they killed creatures. So it's a mixed bag. Mendicants cram this in. Now, to show you how there's certain religious needs that just don't go away. We'll see this very strong in Buddhism. When you watch this, we're going to see this amazing thing where Buddhism starts out completely against the Vedic culture and Hinduism, we don't do any of this stuff, and then in 1,000 years, it totally merges back into the very thing, matrix, from which it emerged, then it just merges right back. Because people have certain needs. And so, we have this quote, the most popular religious practices are those of devotion. This is in Jainism. Devotion. Puja. Temple rituals and pilgrimage, Hinduism's most popular religious expressions. So they're in India, and everybody's doing this. Everybody's doing puja. Everybody's worshiping in certain ways. And so they even have Ambika. They have a mother goddess. And they have heaven where there's gods, but the jinas are above the gods. And so they end up with heavens. There are different levels of heaven. There's earthly regions. There are hells, but the hells get colder and colder. I guess, you know, from a, you're in a tropical country, it's the cold that frightens you. And so... again, the highest cultural and religious ideals revolve around non-violence, non-attachment. Again, this negative thing. Another interesting thing, anekantavada. In Sanskrit, an means not. It's just like, and then ek, well, never mind. No time for the Sanskrit. They have this thing, anekantavada, which is the doctrine that there's not only one point of view. And they use this to attack. There were centuries ago, there were these knockdown, drag-out intellectual debates between Buddhists and Jains and the Vedic thing and different Vedic people. And it was intellectually a very dynamic culture. And so the Jains thought they had this knockout punch that you've all got a sectarian position and we just, you know, we sort of go with the flow and you've got a sectarian, one-pointed position. But then it evolved into a type of ecumenical thing in modern times. You might have read that in the... In the article. Are there any questions about this? Just trying to... Here's one interesting quote I found on a website, you know, sort of browsing, surfing the web, find all kinds of things. Now, I'm saying this is authoritative. This is one take on Jainism. It's a website called All About Jainism, which seemed to be somewhat, it said, sympathetic. It said, they rejected the gods of Hinduism, but now practically every existing thing is a god. The mountains and earth and stones have a soul. Every plant, every animal is a god. This leads to respect for the sanctity of life. So it's just sort of an ironic, paradoxical thing. Jainism, the book says it's kind of a mystery as to why Jainism survived as a separate religion, Indian Buddhism didn't. I don't think it's such a mystery, really. I guess what I'll argue as we go on in the course is that Buddhism sort of went with the times. There was a sort of a zeitgeist, you know, the spirit of the times. And as the Vedic culture reinvented itself, retooled, became extremely competitive, and eventually kind of took over again, Buddhism accommodated itself to that. And Buddhism competed with Hinduism by taking on all the more successful, popular, dynamic features of Hinduism, so that eventually it kind of merged back in. Whereas Jains kept themselves distinct. For example, although in Jainism, at a certain point in history, let's say about 500 or 600 years ago, all over the Jain world, people were worshipping, had gods and goddesses, and basically looked like Hindus, there was a reaction against that. A group called the Stanaka Vasis, quote, rejected the temple and image worship practices that were ubiquitous at the time. They instituted the mouth shields. So Jainism sort of, you know, held the line, we're not going to be like the Hindus, but the Hindus were doing what they were doing because that's what everybody wanted, and it was working, and so the Jains kind of marginalized themselves, whereas Buddhism, to a great extent, went back toward Hinduism. What was left of Buddhism, basically the Muslims killed, and we'll talk about that later in the course. Violent attack on Buddhism, on Indian Buddhism, by the Muslims. So, anyway, any other questions on Jainism? Yes?
Can you clarify the highest destination or the destination of the soul?
Yeah, it was sort of to go to some kind of heaven in this world, but even that, you may notice in the article you read, it says nothing about where you go. I mean, I didn't find anything in that article. And that's an article in a sort of a standard textbook done by two scholars at the University of Florida, actually. Neither of them are here right now. But and there's not a word about where you go. So it's like, give up this, give up that, and then you'll get moksha. But where is moksha? What happens? So I think perhaps later on they start talking about heavens, because everybody else had heavens and you had to have heavens. But in the original Jainism, it's not really clear. Anyway, so hopefully if the world is still here, we'll see you Friday and start talking about Buddhism.